Maybe it's the last night. So we just made it to the top of the mountain in, was it slide 28? When the music cut in, which is my sort of cue really to stop the lectures getting too long. So I hope that's working for you. And we'll try and get to the end of this sort of first key water section in this 20-minute section. And it's really, we started to lay out really the foundations of some of the bigger themes that we're going to be talking about. Okay. When the world was a sign with this and that, I was young, didn't know to hold it back. Now we're here in the world, something else. We could leave any day and call for help. We were gods, nobody was above me. The A on my chest like a Dolce. The A on my chest, put your fist up. The A on my chest like a chipmunk. Alvin, Theodore, breathe in, breathe out. Me and more, breathe in, breathe out. Never mind, it was time. Number nine, lies, feline, with a death wish. Be right, didn't help shit. No name on a guest list. Hold on, we're destined. The whole landscape affects the flow of rain and the buildup of moisture in a system. And we've kind of progressed from the sea to the top of the mountain. I think we just reached that part when we ran out of time in the previous lecture. And the thing that we didn't really get to explore was the idea of cloud forest. And some of the most productive, some of the most amazing biodiverse environments on the planet are where you get this very special set of conditions high up in a mountain system where the amount of rain is equal to the evaporation. So there's almost a kind of a permanent circulation of moisture at that point. And it's interesting just to think about that potential within landscape for rainfall and evaporation to kind of be equal to each other and have a set of conditions, almost sort of permanent sort of, I don't know, humidifying of a landscape. And the potential for that to create really diverse and really productive environments. So it's really just an interesting thought. Let's just jump into this picture. You'll notice there's kind of a cylinder, a sort of a section cut out in the middle of the forest, and that takes us to slide 29, or actually to slide 30, out of sync slightly. if we just have a look at slide 30, and we'll jump back to 29. In the middle of our forest system, we're imagining, you know, heavy rainfall landing onto the forest, and we're told that the 25% of the water doesn't even get to touch the floor. It is literally just evaporates again back off the surfaces of the trees and rehumidifies the environment again. To think about how important that is in the total system. And also we talked about the uniqueness of this evaporated water off trees actually brings nuclei and bacteria and all sorts of potential nutrients and things which circulating through the forest through the rainfall. 48.5%, so nearly half, so nearly a quarter of the water that falls on a forest doesn't even reach the floor. And nearly half is returned to the atmosphere by a transpiration through the trees. And only 25.9%, according to this diagram, actually, you know, becomes surface water runoff, forming obviously streams and rivers. And absolutely critically, this is the fact I think that we most need to look at is evaporation from the forest floor. From the forest soil is zero. So there's as soon as we start cutting into forests, as soon as we start exposing forest soils, there's something that's going to happen to them that's never happened to them before, which is they're going to lose water through evaporation. So this is really key. This is why we really bang on so much about mulching and shading and stacking in our permaculture systems, is because we have to protect this soil in every way that we can. Now we just jump back a slide to slide 29. This is North Wales, and we're looking over, maybe as kind of a system that we might have been thinking about. It's obviously a temperate one. And what we're seeing is it's just after a rainfall. And we're looking over a forest system and we can just see that evapotranspiration. We can see that that proportion of the rainfall is just immediately evaporating and returning to the air. And I think something in my own thinking was I'd always underestimated just how important condensation is, how much moisture is returned to the landscape just by cooling air falling. And obviously the precursor to that is warm air rising and taking the humidity up. So I really like this analogy of thinking about the landscape kind of breathing and seeing it as more as a living system. If we move forward to slide 31, I think it was almost the same day actually in North Wales. I was travelling up to the North Wales coast and we went up through, came through the mountains. It was sort of getting dusk time and the air was cooling down. And you could see the opposite effect happening. You could see the condensation of the moisture in the air was very quickly sort of becoming heavier and colder and then dropping down over the landscape and sort of blanketing the landscape. So again, nice to think about this sort of almost breathing of the natural world, natural system. Okay, so let's jump to slide 32, and this is just a few thoughts. You could take your time out of this, really look at some of these diagrams without me chattering away. thinking just a bit more detail about how water interacts with trees. So you can imagine, actually in heavy rainfall, and you know this if you've been in the tropics, is that that rainfall has a really destructive force. It comes down with great power. Sometimes and itself can be very erosive. So the first thing that we're noticing is that heavy rainfall, when it hits the tree, those big raindrops are shattered into almost like a mist. The kinetic energy, the force of the rainfall is broken by the tree, and that water then can drip and flow and trickle its way through the tree, down the trunk, over the leaves, and drip, 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 much more slowly onto the ground, and then the ground is then able to receive it and absorb it. This is the thing that we realize is so important, is it takes time for water to soak into the ground, and that's where we want it to go. So anything that we can do to slow it down by using strategically and valuing trees for the many different things that they contribute. We talked about an element performing multiple functions. Well, this again is such an important function of what a tree does is to protect the soils beneath it. Notice we've got things like a crown drip. So actually, a lot of plants, well, once they've accepted enough water, they throw off the surplus around off the plants, around the edges. And that gives us a little special little niche and an opportunity perhaps to plant at those edges and to harvest that water. But also I noticed there's a lovely little sort of line going around of the tree, the crown drip feeding the tree roots, and then the tree roots returning that same water back to the atmosphere. So it's time to think about how the tree itself sort of harvests, holds, and then communicates, if you like, the water that's passing through it. And there's a lovely exploration of all of the different associations and relationships that the tree is forming with the soil and the soil biota. So do maybe pause and have an explore of that diagram, try to understand how these forces interact with each other. We go on to slide 33, and this is just looking on a forest floor. This is in a community garden in North Wales, where they'd harvest a lot of a pioneer nitrogen fixing shrub called gorse and piled up the logs around the edge of the garden. And I was just looking and seeing how they were decomposing and how there was this flush of mushrooms growing on this rotting wood. And I just then started to really, I just got an insight at that moment about how the ground becomes this amazing sponge that just holds so much moisture. And to contrast that to bare soil, which obviously just can't do that. It just doesn't have that ability. So that's how we get erosion and systems breaking down, is because we're losing this biological mat, the sponge that can hold the water where it is and make it available locally. So slide 34, I really like this slide. I come back and look at it more and more. And I think, again, it's one of the really fantastic illustrations within Bill's book. and it's exploring the relationships between trees and in a system. And so in a couple of slides back, we looked at an individual tree and how water might flow through that. And in this one, we're trying to see the tree as a part of a wider community. Now, the first thing that Bill is suggesting is that we could see our central tree. He calls that a cooperative. Let's think of it as the tree itself as a whole community, and he's put birds and squirrels and insects and leaf borers and all sorts of butterflies and things into the diagram to really help us understand that concept, that the tree itself is like almost a city of diversity and of different interactions. And we could sort of draw down into that and look at the sort of individual components within it. And in permaculture, so we're very, very interested in the way that all of these things interact together to create a whole. We're introduced to the idea underneath of the soil's cooperative community. Think about the mycorrhizal fungi, all of the different soil organisms that are there interacting with the tree, interacting with the roots, and receiving sugars and exchanging nutrients with the tree. There are other elements within the tree. So again, I've touched on this before. Also, is I love the idea that he's got a little thing there. This insects give sugars to the roots. So he's reminding us too that insects are chomping away, eating the tree, eating the leaves and so forth, and constantly their droppings are falling on the ground and actually helping build the soil and the complexity of the soil. So there's all sorts of different communications going in different ways around our tree. If we move to the left-hand side of the picture, we can see how then Bill introduces the word guild. So a guild is a number of species that work together as a whole to create long-term stability and to sort of boost the cycling of nutrients and boost those interactions. So, and one of the elements one of the sort of details within this picture is this idea that the roots of the trees are ultimately joined together by the mycorrhizae, by these fungi that infuse the roots. They actually can connect one tree to another. And there's been a lot of very interesting studies done on that now, that trees can pass water, nutrients, antibodies, and hormones through their roots to other trees. And they can go through the mycorrhizal fungi that's attached to a different species of tree and then reach another tree from their species. In many ways, the trees are dynamically responding to their environment and they are nursing each other. They're interacting with each other in all sorts of different ways, which is really fascinating to think about. We've also got a bird in there as a key element of the system, because they're messengers, they're distributors of seeds and distributors of nutrients. Many trees rely on relationships with birds to translocate their seeds, to spread out their habitat. So if we move from a cooperative to a guild to a family. A family maybe that brings many guilds together. That's our forest system. I like the idea. We've got in our right-hand circle, we have the system as a teacher. And we have a person sat there on a pile of stones observing the forest. Something that Bill Mollison says in one of his videos is, if we lost all the universities in the world, we've lost nothing. If we've lost the forests, we've lost everything. And by that he really means is, the natural world is our teacher, and by studying it and interacting with it, There's so much to be revealed. Okay, so again, it's do come back and look at some of these pictures. I'm going to move on. I think this is a really wonderful idea they're bringing together of the interconnectedness. And to understand that when we're farming, when we're gardening, we shouldn't just be thinking about the target crop, about the yield that we want to create. We want to understand that as farmers and gardeners, we're building a whole ecosystem that supports all of the components of the system, which includes the crops that you want to grow. Okay, next slide is about how wind shapes trees, and again, it's a sort of a thought about how the conditions in the landscape create, you know, give shape and or a uniqueness to any particular space, and that the plants or trees and things that are growing are also growing in a way in which they are being shaped by the spaces that they're in, by their actual location. Slide 36 is an exploration of how we might plant on the upper slopes. If we start to think about how we can restore our damaged landscapes, and Bill's very clear in the books and his research that once you get above a sort of 18% slope, the only really use for that, or the most important function for that, would be to stabilize it with trees. But how do we do that? Well, this is I think they call this a net and pan system. What we can see is very small interactions, build walls around just a shallow wall around below the tree, each tree that wants to be reinforced, so that when there's a natural flow of water down the hill, some of that is slowed down and retained. And most importantly, it's not just the water that's retained, but it's any soil particles and nutrient particles that are washing down through the system. And we're going to explore all of this in a much more detail. It gets technical. But I want to bring these concepts alive for you in your imagination. So moving on to 37, we're seeing a series of pictures of what happens as landscape breaks down. So as we remove the trees and the runoff, surface runoff accelerates, and we start to experience soil erosion, and then we also see effective water logging and salting happening as well as the natural water flow is affected. So again, something just to think about in the bigger picture. I'm going to skip over 38, but again, we're exploring the breakdown of a system, and what we're really interested in permaculture is how we're going to reverse those processes. So we need to understand what's going on. And so we can get quite technical about this, but we're looking at the bigger picture still, trying to get an overall overview. So, trapping water into landscapes, the cheapest, most effective way to do it is to get water to soak into the soil. So if our number one strategy is to try and get water, is to literally just to get the water to percolate into the soil, we can catch obviously rainwater in containers, which is very useful if we want to hold it above ground, and especially for things like drinking water. But rainwater tanks are expensive, and what I've seen a lot of in my sort of research and travels around Africa is lots of buildings and schools and things have had rainwater harvesting tanks put in, and then they've not been maintained for some reason, so they're failing. So again, it's quite a big infrastructure investment that doesn't always give you the return. So I always push people to think about storage of water in the ground first. Dams. Now, there's a whole series of pictures now here about different kinds of dams and strategies for trapping water in the landscape. And I'm going to pass over these just because it's very technical. I can't claim that I've ever built a dam or I have the experience of it. But what we can see here is a range of strategies where we can sculpt the landscape in a way in which it will trap water into the dam. There's a great video from Jeff Lawton of dam building, which is not on YouTube, but it is a, the resources are out there. I think that these series of pictures show, though, how we can work whole landscapes by with strategic placement of dams. So, and also bearing in mind that all dams are going to fill up with water and at some point overflow. So can we send that overflow to the next part of the system, catching and storing water by using the whole landscape? I'm going to just pause on slide 46, if I may, and where we're seeing again a sort of a series of dams, and there's some really wonderful again lots of instructive videos out there on how to do this stuff, so I'm not going to labor on it too much, but there's some key principles here which need to be explored. So the first thing in our upper catchment dam, we can see that they've built extra channels, and not quite swales, but diversion drains that bring extra surface water into that catchment. Now, rule number one is if we're moving around, we want to be as if we're moving water around in a landscape, you want it to move as slowly as possible so it cannot erode. So you'll notice how there's diversion drains at the top of the system are almost level, just enough to make the water trickle in the direction that we want. And then as the dam fills up, it's got an upper catchment spillway. It's got somewhere for that water to go. It can flow out and then round and come down again as close to horizontal as possible. So the water is moving very, very slowly. I don't know if we've got some little check dams in there or something just to prevent that water from moving too quickly. And then the next thing is to say is if that system was to become overfilled with water, because this is the challenge that we've got to design for both drought and deluge. We're going to have experience both extremes, especially as you move into a more climate-changed world. So move water as slowly as possible, and if it's going to discharge, if it's going to overflow, then make it overflow into vegetation, into trees. So you can see here that between the first and second dam, there's a tree system there, which is designed to mop up any extra flow, stabilize the soils, prevent erosion, and encourage the percolation of water back into the soils again. And we see our lower catchment dam, so it's being fed off the one above it. And then here to the right of that, we've got a fun sort of crazy thing, the stepped chinampa. And I love that. I haven't seen one of these constructed yet. I think I have on video. But the idea that so then instead of just allowing the water to flow out of the system, it flows into a level, which is all into a special bed, like a trench bed, which receives the excess flow, and in the water then, because it's ever so slightly off level, will travel from the left to the right with an overflow and then be caught by the next one beneath it. And as you can see, is that we're making the water do the longest journey possible. So water has work to do as it passes through the landscape. It has to irrigate, nourish, and humidify the landscape. Our strategies are hold as much of it as we can into the system, hold it as high as we can into the system, move it around as slowly as possible. If we discharge water, we discharge into vegetation, and we make the water travel the longest distance possible so that it can do the nourishing and hydrating of the landscape. These are our key principles. These are the ideas that you need to take away in your head and not forget. So we're nearly at the end of this. This next slide, 47, sun trap. So look at the top, see the top image, and what we're seeing there is a repeating pattern going down a landscape where we've got some trees, we've got some kind of a hen house or something, we've got a grazing system, and then we've repeated that system again. So this is a very interesting kind of permaculture technique of integrating trees and crops into the landscape in a way in which they help stabilize that landscape, but also that they help create microclimate. They influence the climate within on a local scale. So if we look at the image below, which is a sort of three-dimensional expansion of what we might be seeing above, and you'll notice that this sort of boomerang shape of trees is designed to deflect cold air that might be pouring down the mountain in the evening. Remember, cold air is heavier. Warm air will rise off this in the evening. Cold air will come down the mountain. And the idea is that the trees deflect it either side from where we've got our chickens and we've got a crop growing there. So simple strategies based on observation that kind of create microclimate. The other thing that we can say about this is it's open to the sun, the sunning side, and harvesting as much of the sun.
See, now I just want to live forever and ever.